Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Pocahontas, Arkansas, and earned an MA and a PhD in government from Claremont Graduate School. He became the 12th president of Hillsdale College in 2000. Hillsdale, established in 1844, is an independent, coeducational, non-sectarian, liberal arts college. He's one of the world's leading experts on the life of Winston Churchill and the author of Liberty and Learning, The Evolution of American Education. His name? Dr. Larry Arn. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Dr. Larry Arn, who since 2000 has been the 12th president of Hillsdale College, which was established in 1844. Doctor, welcome. A real honor to have you.
It's an honor to be with you, Jack. You're an inspiring man.
Thank you. Can we start to talk about your childhood in Pocahontas, Arkansas, and your mom and your dad, please?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, my parents grew up in the hills of Arkansas on Depression-era farms. They met at a revival meeting in Calamine, Arkansas. My dad was the first in his family, going back as far as you can go, to go to college. He worked at first for Phillips Petroleum. He did a few other things, and then he found his happiness becoming a school teacher. I remember, as he told me, he started out making $7,500 a year. He retired 30-plus years later making $38,000 a year. Thought it was a lot. And he always worked two jobs. My mom often worked. They had three children, two sisters and me, and they were steady, hard-working, fine people.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Dad, Larry, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom?
My dad was he loved books, and he loved young people. He loved teaching them. And so we were taught by both our parents to take school seriously. You were supposed to do well, and supposed to do as well as you could. My dad loved sports. I loved and love sports. I like to say if I'd been any good at sports, I'd be as ignorant as the daylights today. But I couldn't play in college, but I played in high school, and my dad celebrated that. I hunted with my dad a lot. My dad had a bunch of brothers, and they would all get together and go hunting, and I would go and try to keep up with them when I was a little boy. My mom was everybody's mom. She was one of the most loving people I've ever known. And when there was the occasional snow in Arkansas, which was a delightful thing down there and rare, unlike up here in Michigan, the best sledding hill in town was next to our house. And all the kids, if you got off a day of school, that was a triumph. And all the kids would gather, but they all knew that there was a huge pot of hot chocolate in our kitchen, and they could just walk in and get some. So I grew up like that.
You decide to have a life in education. What's the purpose of education?
That comes from a Latin word that means to lead forth, and it raises the question, which way is forth, which is the right way for a human being to go? And so education is to equip you to that, and there are various things that it has to encompass. It has to encompass the basic skills that every human being needs, and that's reasoning skills, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Those are operations of a rational intellect, and we're the only beings that we know that have them. So first of all, you need to be trained in that. You need to get good at those things. You need to be able to write and to read and to compute. And you need to learn to love those things, too. And then after you get that, then there's a lot of knowledge you need, and that's, you know, of the past and of literature and philosophy and of history. The story of our country. Oh, the natural sciences, that was what I was going to add. You need to know how the world works. You need to know what we know about the world, its physical properties. And so education is about that. And then finally, and at the highest level, Education is about the great questions that human beings have to face. And the best education, in our opinion here and mine, is that it involves reading the great authors on those questions down through time. And that what you will encounter if you do is you'll come to understand what profundity is, what the really most serious works are like, and then you'll meet the puzzle that they don't all agree with each other. And that's an invitation to you to guide your life thoughtfully, not just in light of what they thought, but what you think. So that's what it's about.
Hillsdale College was established in 1844. That means this year we're going to celebrate 175 years. And in 2000, you're named the 12th president. Only 12 presidents in 175 years. How did you get the president's job in 2000?
Well, it's curiosity. I got it partly because I didn't want it. There's a lot of colleges, and their presidents don't tend to last very long, and so there's always college president jobs going. And I was not attracted to them, nor to this one. But then I discovered something in the course of it, and partly I stood out, I guess, because I think they had 700 names. I stood out because I was the one who didn't want it and told them that several times. And that, it's like one way to court a girl, or a girl, especially for a girl to court a boy. So they kept at it, and then I discovered something, and it was kind of an accident. In 1844, Hillsdale College was founded by a very beautiful document. That document was written by people who became important in the cause of Abraham Lincoln. Some of them came to know him. And they're very much my kind of people. And I learned about those people because a lawyer persuaded me to ask for the Articles of Incorporation and the bylaws. Kind of a bureaucratic, legalistic idea. And I said I wasn't going to do the job. And he said, never mind, humor me. I'm a lawyer and I'm your friend. So I asked him for those two documents. And what came is very beautiful. And I fell in love with it, and that led me to read the college's history. And then I got a phone call again from him again, and I said, okay, I'll talk to you. And they said, changed your mind. And I said, I did. And they said, why? And I said, I'll tell you when you get here. And when they got here, I passed out that document, the Articles of Association of 1844 of Hillsdale College. And some of them didn't know what it was. But it doesn't matter about that, see, because the original thing, there's a Latin word with the word principle, principia, and that word means both first and defining. It's like the principle of a plant is in its seed, and so the original thing is important. And if you abandon the original thing, then you've started a new thing. And so our original thing turns out to be very beautiful, and I thought of that as a calling and also, I confess, a weapon, because if you ask people to agree to cooperate in the name of the original thing, then you're not asking them to agree with you, because, that won't work. We're all thinking people, and just because I say so, it's not the deal. And also, I'm not the college. I'm only the 12th to lead it, and those 12 leaders have all done a minority of the work in the college. So the point is, we need some principle of cooperation. The word college means partnership. And I just put all that together in my mind, and it took me like 20 minutes one night in my house in Claremont, California. And I went and read it to my wife, and she said, that's pretty, what is it? And I told her, and she said, my God, are we moving to Michigan from Southern California? So that's my part of it, was that. And why they wanted me, there'd be better spokesmen than I, but I had done the things you need to do in various ways. I had a PhD, and I had written things of purportedly academic quality, and I had run an organization, and it had done well, and I had helped to raise the revenue for that organization. And I had some idea about human relations, how to get along with people you work with. So those things I had all that, and that made me a serious candidate, I guess. And then that document brought us all together, as it has people at Hillsdale College for soon 175 years.
And 19 years later, Dr. Arne is still running.
Yeah, there we go.
Penelope, not only did you convince her to move to Michigan, but in the middle of nowhere in Michigan. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with, in my opinion, a modern-day Charles Krauthammer. Dr. Larry Arne. Doctor, tell us about Hillsdale College.
It's a small, close liberal arts college. It's liberal arts in the old-fashioned sense. Half the curriculum is same for every student. That means that the football players and the guys who go to the top five law schools and grad schools, they're all studying the same thing half the time. That means there's no easy way through here. It also means that the faculty works in cooperation because everybody, each of the major departments that have a core course to teach, they get every student. And one of the delightful things that happens in a college is you have a conversation among everybody in every class. And other faculty members and other books and other students come up all the time. So it turns it into a thing where it's a college. Remember, that word means partnership. It proceeds by argument and evidence and proof. That's how colleges work. So you've got to be able to argue what you think. And I like to say the one agreement we never make around here is to disagree. Because if we disagree, somebody's wrong, and we've got to try to get to the bottom of it. But alas, we do disagree a lot around here, but not about the activity of the college, the mission and purpose of the college. That's the one thing we all really do have to agree about for us to do our work properly together, and we do agree about that here, and that's because we have an honor code that requires students to say so, and faculty members and staff members, when they're hired, are asked to make a commentary on that 1844 document that I love. So we sort of lay the ground of our cooperation and competition at the beginning, and that means we don't fight much and not about ends around here, although we argue just about everything you can imagine. So it's the college is, you know, well known across the country. There are millions of people who attend Hillsdale College, many millions, and we get visitors out the bazoo now, and we have online courses, and there have been more than 2 million people enroll in those. And all of that is just a radiation from this close, you know, excellent elite activity that goes on here. And that's sort of what it is. It's very local. As you say, it's in the middle of nowhere, but it's also very national because we just go all over the country, and our students come from all 50 states.
Speaking of national, speaking of millions of people, this is the 48th year of Imprimis. Mm. So 12 months a year, 3.9 million of us get this little pamphlet in the mail. Tell us about Imprimis.
Yeah, that was started, I'm glad you said the number because I wouldn't have been able to recall it, but that was started, you know, back in the 70s, early 70s, and it had a mailing list of under 1,500. And the idea behind it, Imprimis is a Latin expression that means in the first place. And the idea was that we would just send out something of note that reflects the disposition of the college in some way. And it's a speech digest, so it's people who come and give speeches for Hillsdale College. And there are, as you say, only 12 of them a year. But I think we may host 100 people a year to give speeches, so most don't get in, and it's very big now, so people would like to. It's free. You don't have to give us any money. We never give your name to anybody else. We could make a killing selling the list now, but we've never done that. And every year some important person comes with a brilliant idea and charts out for us how much we could make if we would sell our mailing list to other people. And we always send them away disappointed. So it's like that, and it's not commercial in its nature. In general, if you get Imprimis or if you come to a college event, you'll discover that nobody asks you for money. A lot of people give money to Hillsdale College, but they're volunteers, and they give of their own generosity and not ours. So it's like that, and it's good, and it's been, of course, some really extremely important people in it over the years. You know, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and Clarence Thomas and, you know, many great people. And then lots of serious scholars talking about something of note in public life today.
If you want to learn more, www.hillsdale.edu. Larry, speaking of never asking for money, in the 175-year history of Hillsdale College, it's never received $1 from any federal, state, or local government. Why?
Well, that's an interesting story. I mean, first of all, for most of our history, that wasn't a question, right? Because the federal government didn't do that. And if you look at the list of things that are in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, education is not among them, although education was extremely important to the founders, and they gave it a huge gift in 1/36 of the western lands, which they gave to states, which they thought were the proper authorities to regulate and fund education, to use as endowments for education in each township. So the point is, the question never arose until about 1960, after the Sputnik, and there have been many changes of opinion that have led to massive changes in our government since then, that they wanted to get involved, and so they used the launching of the Sputnik as a reason to start giving aid to colleges. And the aid that came was first mostly, there were lots of grants that you could apply for, and that's what we've never done. We've never had a grant from the government. For about 15 years, 20 years, we did let students participate in the federal student aid, because those things were originally founded and promoted as aid to the student. And so then the student could take it and spend it wherever the student wanted. But that changed in the Carter administration, and they took the view that if you received this aid through the students, you were subject to the full panoply of federal regulation. And so we refused, and we have a lawsuit, and it took 10 years, and eventually got to the Supreme Court of the United States, where I like to say we fell only 5 votes short. We lost 9-0. And, you know, just 5 more and we would have been there. But, and I'm, you know, not myself, I wasn't here then, but I'm not unhappy about that, because our reaction to that was, now all the student aid, loans, everything, there's just no money that comes into this college from any government agency at any level. And that's good, because the, you know, first of all, the, for example, Title IV is where the student financial aid is. And to become eligible for Title IV, you have to sign a document that commits you to obey several hundred pages of complex rules that change all the time. And we don't have any equivalent to that here. We don't have several hundred pages of rules of any kind. The student rules at Hillsdale College number exactly 17 in number. And they take up just over a page of paper. And we believe that human beings are better governed by goals than by rules. And so, you know, you don't make a lot of things illegal. You adopt a goal and then pursue it together. Well, that's the way the government of the United States used to work, and works in the Constitution extensively, where the Constitution is still the model. But we, and, you know, we had no idea back in the day, because, you know, I happen to have read a lot of the history of the college. I really love the early history of the college because it's glorious. But the modern history is very interesting, too, and often glorious. And when that first became offered, you know, like, how do you decide that you won't let a student who wants to come to you, who's got a grant from the government, bring it to you? Well, we decided to do that. And then there was a motion on our board of trustees by the richest man on the board in 1967. He had a task force, 3 people on it, and they came back and reported that we had to start seeking direct grants from the federal government or else we were going to go broke. And that was the wealthiest man on the famous Michigan name that I will not say here. And there's an 11 single space pages of minutes of that meeting in our records. And then they voted 16-3 not to do it. And then the then president of the college, the 10th, J. Donald Phillips, said a prayer for the future of the college. So that's a kind of an inspiring thing, and it was a very principled thing to do. And that's, and those were made because, you know, it looks different today because we're used to it, and it's very unusual. And so we've had, you know, 60 years to get accustomed to this and figure it out. But in the beginning, this was just a new problem. And they were thinking it through while they went.
We're talking to Dr. Larry Arn. When we come back, we're going to ask him about a Chicago family that in 2009 provided a $2 million challenge grant. And what's happened to that initiative since? And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Dr. Larry Arn, who's an expert on the life of Winston Churchill. Larry, in 2009, the Barney family out of Chicago, Illinois, gave a $2 million challenge grant. 10 years later, what's happened?
Well, the grant was to Steve Barney is a trustee of the college, a friend of mine, and he has the great attribute that he cries a lot. And he gets all sentimental about something, and he cries over it. And so one day he poked me in the chest about 10 times and said, I personally, Larry Arn, in Hillsdale College, had to go do something about K through 12 education because these kids are growing up and they don't know anything. And so I had thought about that subject because he's not the first person to say things like that to me. And I said, I have an idea what we do. And he said, what? And I said, we might help to found and guide and manage charter schools. We might give them their curriculum. We might help them hire their headmaster. We might teach their teachers. And we'll never take a nickel from them. So we have 20 charter schools now after 10 years, and there are four more opening next year, including one in Michigan, the second one in Michigan. And it's been going on for 7 or 8 years now, and we've spent some millions of dollars on it by now, but none of those schools has ever paid us for anything. One of the key ways it works, so first of all, we have a curriculum, and you have to agree, if you want us to help you, to use our curriculum. And you can adapt it in various ways, but everybody has to learn Latin, everybody has to wear uniforms, everybody has an honor code, everybody studies math through pre-calculus. We teach reading through phonics. We get tremendous results from that. Except for two or three who have some actual impairment, we've never graduated a kindergartner who couldn't read. A big thing is in the summer, if you want to come visit anybody from Michigan, come here in the summer because for about 8 weeks in the summer, hordes of teachers from all these charter schools descend on the college and spend a week in workshops with each other and with our faculty. And those are very inspiring. Last year, there was more than 500 teachers came to those. And this year will be bigger because there are more schools. And it's that thing. And we've got some data about it. It's old enough now that we're studying it and trying to figure out if we're doing any good. An inspiring man named Ben Payne, who works in the Barney Project, he figured out the following. There are 20 schools. Knock out the two most recently founded, because there's only a year data. 18 schools. Their student bodies are 42% members of racial minorities, and the 84% of those 18 schools, and those 18 schools are in 9 different states with 9 different sets of state standards and 9 different sets of state comprehensive exams for every student in those schools, and 84% of our 18 schools are performing at the highest level in those states, and yet they all have exactly the same curriculum, and they don't pay much attention to the state standardized test. So that's kind of interesting. And there's a joke we like to tell, and that is, if you want a whole lot of people to pass some examination that's given by people they never meet, and written by people who never meet them, if you're going to get everybody to pass it, you're going to have to make it easy. And so we do pass those very well, but we do better than that too. We've got excellent college admission records and all that. And the schools have, last count, 11,000 students and 6,000 on the wait list trying to get in.
www.hillsdale.edu. We're talking a lot, Dr. Larry Iron, a modern-day crusader for our Constitution. Speaking of which, Doctor, how brilliant were our forefathers that gave us our Constitution?
Yeah, see, that's my answer is the most brilliant of all such people in history, and there have been brilliant ones in other places too, but that's controversial today because we don't, you know, the founders are old and dead and white, and so we rule them out. But the truth is, just think of the story of America, because it's unprecedented and still unexampled. A bunch of people came over here for a variety of reasons, in bits and drabs, over 150 years. Because early 17th century, the first settlements, late 18th century, the Revolution. And what did they do? They still, at the time of the Revolution, didn't know how big the country was. Washington named his army the Continental Army, and nobody had ever got to the other side of the continent and come back. So he didn't really know what he was naming it after. But they got this idea of freedom, and they worked on it. And there were two crises. The first was a war over the principle of the king, which is, I was born to rule you, and it's my duty, and it's your duty to obey. And the principle of government by consent, because all men are created equal. That was the war, and that established the principle, or what we call in classic philosophy, the final cause of the nation, the ultimate purpose of it, what it's for. And then the second thing is the Constitution, because to have everybody participate in the government, there has to be forms. There has to be ways that they do that. And the ways have to become customary, and they have to allow for common deliberation, and they have to be regular in their system. If you want to just have one person rule, you can do what Adolf Hitler actually did. This is his first act to become chancellor. He canceled the Constitution and passed an act that enabled, it's called the Enabling Act, that let him do whatever he wanted, right? Well, you don't need any rules for that. Just whatever he decides today is what happens. But if you want everybody to participate in a meaningful way, you need a system that's sophisticated and that distributes and checks power. And the Constitution of the United States is the greatest thing, the greatest achievement in that area in human history by a massive margin. There's nothing else like it, and it is the longest surviving written Constitution in all of history. And it's controversial today, as it tends to be whenever there are fundamental disagreements in politics, and I hope to vindicate the good of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence in my career, as this college was founded to do.
We're talking to Dr. Larry Iron, the author of Liberty and Learning, The Evolution of American Education. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the 12th president of Hillsdale College in its 175 years, Dr. Larry Iron. Larry, the founders set up three branches, the presidential, Congress, judicial. Congress was going to write the laws, pass the laws, but what's happened, in, as far as I could tell, is they passed very few laws of importance, and the president, with executive order and all of his departments, just issuing regulations, and then the Supreme Court are the ones making all the decisions and the changes. What do we do?
That's right. A wise friend of mine said that the branches have fought into each other's clothes. The courts are a legislature, and Congress is an executive regulatory body, and the president is kind of an ombudsman for everybody. But, you know, go back a second. So in classic thought, things are defined by four causes, and the two most important I've named: a final cause, which means what does it love, what does it seek, and a formal cause, which is what does it look like, how does it appear. And the formal cause of the United States is the Constitution of the United States. And if you just look, Washington, D.C., original, if you go look at just the beautiful buildings in Washington, D.C., you'll see they're built around those three branches. Each has a beautiful home, and the home is expressive of its purpose. But now Washington, D.C. looks entirely different, and that's because it's a massive regulatory state. And 9/10 of the laws are not made in the Congress now. They're made in executive branch agencies that were unknown to the Constitution, and that each agency in its subject matter combines the executive and judicial and legislative branches under a single head. So, for example, when the Department of Education came after us in 1974, and we refused to comply, and so they sued us, and we had to go to Denver. In Denver, for goodness sake, for some reason. They were in Washington, and we were in Michigan, so they held the hearings in Denver, and the person we pled before, the judge, was an employee of the Secretary of Education. And it's only after we got through all of that, and, you know, in a miraculous development, we won in front of that guy. But then, as soon as we won, the Secretary of Education, his name was Califano, did what he had the authority to do. He vacated the decision, and only then could we start over again in the regular courts. You see, and that's, you see what that means? That means that the regs under which we were being prosecuted were passed by people who worked for Joe Califano, and they were enforced by people who worked for Joe Califano, and the judges who judged disputes worked for Joe Califano. And that's not separation of powers. And that's how almost all government works today. And it's grown up over the course of about 70 years.
In December, you wrote the In Primis for that month. And it was entitled, Do We Need Our Country Anymore? And you talked about that the 100th Armistice Day, the annual remembrance of November 11th, 1918, the end of World War I, President Macron of France gave a famous keynote speech. What did you write about that in Primus in December?
Well, he built his speech. You know, Europe is racked with controversy about the European Union and about a, you know, multi-nation government, which is what the European Union has become. It's a multi-nation regulatory agency, and lots of people who live under those regulations don't think they have any real means to affect them. So Macron gave a great defense of the European Union, and he said that nationalism is the opposite of and the enemy of patriotism. So the nation's got to go in the name of patriotism. So I just started by saying, what does the word nation mean? If you look at its etymology, at its source, it actually comes from the Greek word, the Latin word that means nature, natura. And nature starts out with born, to be born. That's the first meaning of the word nature. And so the nation is the place where you're born. But then patriarchy, right? Patria, who's that? Who's the pater? That too is Latin. It's father. So these are actually very close words. And I said that treating one as the enemy of the other is just a bunch of silly wordplay. And then I go on to argue this, that in order for there to be consent of the governed, there has to be a people. And they need to be able to talk to each other. That's why language matters. And so in America, our dealings with each other are not all through official channels. And they mustn't be if we're to control the official channels. Like your show and your life, Jack, as a businessman in Detroit and very civic-minded fellow, you are a sponsor of much civic activity in your private capacity. And that's the key to America. One of the reasons our country is strong is because it belongs to all of us, and all of us help with it. Same thing with Hillsdale College. I like to say, you know, if we're all trying to get the same thing done, we'll achieve a lot more. So the point is, Macron is calling for a world in which these international institutions become the mediator among all the different peoples, because they can't talk to all the different peoples at the same time. And so why wouldn't a better solution just be let those people govern themselves? And yes, that's led to war and strife, but this thing is not going to lead to peace, and it isn't the reason that we've had relative peace since the Second World War. The reason we've had relative peace is two things. The incredible danger of nuclear weapons, which nobody has been willing to dare, and the other is the very great power well used of the United States of America.
As our time winds down tonight, you love Churchill. In your office, he's everywhere. Paintings, bust, books. If Winston Churchill was still alive today, what would he tell us, Larry?
Well, I always answer that same question the same way. I don't know what he would say, but I know what he did say. And I can tell you the main things that he said. What he thought was, a human being is a spirit, blessed with a rational soul, the Lord of creation. And the purpose of government is to protect the human being in the ability to live a fully human life, and to protect it equally for everyone. So limited government, resistance to tyranny, let people be free.
And Dr. Larry Arn, I admire you. Keep up the crusade for our Constitution.
Back at you, Jack.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahol.
Believe in yourself.